HealthIQ.com. It's a great resource for all of us that are out there and running to get good rates on life insurance. Hey, Don, how has trail running improved your health?
Pretty easy on that one, Scott. You know, my blood pressure would be managed with medication if it wasn't for trail running. If I'm trail running, now whether it's, you know, a de-stressor or, you know, you name the physiological change that happens in probably a number of different pathways, but I know that when I'm running, my blood pressure is maintained.
And Health IQ knows that. So what they have done is they've become an advocate for those of us that are health conscious to go to these A-rated life insurance companies and get them to give us better rates. So go to healthiq.com to find out how you can benefit from being a healthy person. Pieces of gear, Trex titanium bone conductive headphones.
Those are the ones that you put outside of your ear and not inside of your ear, right, Scott?
You keep your ears open to your environment around you. Whether you're running in the streets of Manhattan or whether you're up on the trails in British Columbia.
I just gave my Trex titanium to a very good friend because that's what friends do. They share things that they love and they like.
Was it a loaner? Did you give them to him?
No, I gave them to him. I'm not a giver to take her back, Scott. I'm a giver. And so I've been without Trex titanium for a couple of weeks. And I've got a replacement pair that I'm wearing right now. And let me tell you, I know why I gave them to my friend. They're amazing and awesome, and I love them.
They are. They're lightweight. They're made out of titanium so that, you know, they're flexible. They're sweat resistant. They kind of have almost a sticky rubber, so they don't bounce around. That's one thing that with Bluetooth headphones I've had a challenge running is they bounce around too much. These do not bounce around. They kind of rest over your ear. And the bone conductive technology, you know, I'm a fan.
And we go to the battery life on those. Fantastic. Have you compared them with other wireless headsets? I'm really impressed with the battery life.
I'm gonna test out my battery life at a race this weekend because I'm not sure how long it'll last.
It'll last longer than you.
Probably.
Go to
our partners page. And at the very top of that, you can get a 15% off for Trex Titanium.
Hey, Scott, this just in. You know that in-store survey that we've had?
Yeah.
The number one most appreciated product are the hoodies. People are loving the hoodie.
They do. They have the thumb hole. I love the thumb hole.
If you've got the thumb hole and you've got the hood, you've got yourself a product.
You do. And we do have a sale going on, if you're not aware of it, a sale that's going on just until the end of February. So you only have a couple more days to jump on the bandwagon and get some discounts.
It's a celebration of the opening of the store, the remodeling.
That's where we found the time machine.
Wouldn't it be cool to get into a time machine, Scott, and go back to your best race and do it again?
Ooh,
that would be fun.
That would be fun.
We've got to figure out how to dial that in. So go to our website, enter the store, and shop
Moss.
Ladies and gentlemen of the worldwide ultra running community, you are listening to nothing less than the greatest Trail Running Nation podcast on earth. It is the Trail Runner Nation podcast.
The problem with the message above is that it flies in the face of what we know to be true.
We'll Candace, we are such idiots. You don't even you have no idea.
No, I've listened to your podcast for many years, and it's
I do own my own bar. Every Friday morning on I Run Far, we open up and open up the taps.
You're recording this, aren't you, Freeman?
I get everything.
Welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation. I'm Candace Burt.
I'm Scott War.
I'm Don Freeman.
And I'm Andy Jones.
We have a little bit of a delay with the East Coast today. it's a little bit of a slow delay.
If you would, Andy, can you just cut us short a little bit so it's in real time, so it sounds a little better? You'll have to predict when you need to speak. It won't be easy, but you can do it.
I have to say, Andy is the best dressed of all four of us today.
Definitely.
Yeah, he's in a tie, and he's looking good. He's not in his running attire, but he has brought us a word, and as advertised on previous podcasts, this podcast is on the word vulnerability.
This podcast brought to you by vulnerability.
I really love... Here's my favorite thing, and then AJW, you take over and kind of get us going. My favorite thing is to be able to take a single word
and talk for an hour.
Well, we don't know if we'll make it an hour, but I do know that this cast of characters on here, what a fun time just to pick a word out, and I have no idea where it's going. AJW, set us off.
Well, thanks, guys, and great to see everybody again. I've been kind of captivated by this concept for a little while now. I think I've spent better part of my life thinking of vulnerability as a weakness, as something that is, that you strive to avoid and that is best something that you overcome. And I have to say, in the last couple of years in my life, and especially with my running, I've learned to the importance of embracing vulnerability. And while it can be at times seen as a sign of weakness or as of some kind of a liability, I think dealing with vulnerability and making oneself vulnerable is something that could perhaps even be viewed as a strength. And I think in long distance running, in particular, we make ourselves vulnerable so often, particularly when we're out on the edges of our own abilities and experiences and just grappling with the world, that when you're exposed and raw and vulnerable, perhaps you learn what your true best self is. So I thought it would be fun to explore that topic with the four of us today on Trail Runner Nation.
So without going to Merriam-Webster's dictionary, I'm just going to kind of throw out a definition that I've kind of gathered as I've done a little bit of reading for this, and that is vulnerability, putting yourself in a position of either fear or weakness with potential emotional harm or physical harm. Both are very important, mm-hmm. and both play into vulnerability.
You know, I'm interested just to, at the beginning of this podcast, I bet, you know, Candace Burt has become well known for her 200-mile endurance races. Mm-hmm. I would bet that she sees a lot of people that are raw and stripped down and very vulnerable. What are your thoughts on vulnerability as we start the podcast, Candace?
Yeah, I think it there's an element of risk taking involved, and when you take risk, you have this great potential for the reward that you get from that risk, from that vulnerability, or you have the potential to fail, that's certainly failure is one way to look at it, but isn't necessarily a negative thing either. But with the 200-mile runners, they're doing something that's still pretty new of a distance. It's going so far that there's not a lot of people out there to talk to and refer to about it. So I feel like they're sort of on that frontier, and you can definitely see the day before the race at all the pre-race meetings, everybody's really nervous.
What does vulnerability look like in those pre-race meetings? What do you see? Is it in their eyes? Is it in their demeanor? What does it look like?
I usually feel the energy in the room. There's just this nervous kind of excitement. And I think when I feel vulnerable in a way, that I could really grow from, there is this nervousness and this excitement. So it's not just fear, but also like there's, this excitement for trying something new in that vulnerability.
I'd like to say, too, let's be clear, and I think Candace really gets this in all the work she's done with her races. There's a difference between fear and anxiety and vulnerability. I think fear and anxiety at times can be really crippling for people. And I don't mean to downplay them at all, because those are things that can be really challenging. Making yourself vulnerable, however, is a little bit different, in that you're sort of knowingly exposing yourself to something that you may not succeed in, and that you may leave yourself very exposed in the process. And I think that it's out of that exposure, that knowing exposure, that you can come out the other side a better person.
I'd like to build on that very comment that you said there, AJW, because I feel some vulnerability about this podcast, about the content, right? I know the potential of where we can go. It could be outstanding. Or if I've just come up blank, at least for my seat, for my 25% participation, gosh, I could look emotionally void and a fool, and I may not be able to express the things that I would foresee in this. So it potentially has risk of being good, or I risk being kind of a fool or emotionally blank. And so I feel a little vulnerability, but with the supportive cast here, I think it's going to be all right. So let's go. Let's start with your earlier comment, AJW, about running, because this can certainly move into life, relationships, jobs, you know, you name it. But let's start with running, of where the first place that you find vulnerability. And I will just launch this from the point of deciding to become a runner. Mm-hmm. And let's start with that as a point of you have an impression of who you are, what you are. Others around you might feel that he's a good athlete. And going out and becoming a runner might expose you at, quote unquote, now not being a good athlete or not being living up to expectations, personal expectations or others around you. That's that point of vulnerability. So, AJW, let's have you comment about what you think about vulnerability just entering into the sport.
Hey, you know, that's a great question. And I think that aspect of kind of the public notion of making yourself vulnerable, of worrying about maybe not meeting others' expectations of you or somehow failing in the context of who you believe you are or who you'd like to be is often something that prevents people, I think, even from going down a road of making themselves vulnerable. But I have to go back to my first marathon. You know, I was the classic new runner, doing a Runner's World, training program for your first marathon. And I was just extremely nervous about whether or not I could cover 26 miles when I stood on that starting line. And I think I was vulnerable that whole day. And I think it was about 3 hours and 40 minutes worth of feeling vulnerable and just all the way until that finish line, just not sure that I was going to make it. And I really had a strong sense of sort of inferiority looking around, and all these people are better than me and they're faster than me and they've done marathons before. It was, you know, I had to dash a lot of negative self-talk. But then once you accomplish that, you realize, gosh, putting yourself out there into that unknown really has, I came out the other side better. And frankly, that started this 25 year journey to go longer and harder and faster. So that's what it means to me.
You know, I want to even jump a little bit before, you know, where AJW started that first race. You know, I remember when I first started running, I hated running. I didn't do it. And I decided I wanted to. And that first week or so going out and running from my house down to the corner, I did it at night. So nobody could see me walk because I wasn't sure I was going to make it.
Wow. Well, you do live on a 12-mile dirt road before you get to the corner.
But that I think that there may be a lot of people that listen to this podcast that may not be in shape, you know, a little overweight or a lot overweight, and they're afraid to put themselves out there. This vulnerability maybe is crippling their motivation or desire to actually do something.
Candace.
Yeah, I think too, and new runners are afraid to walk a little bit. Or I know that I used to be. I mean, I'll still walk if I feel like the training run's supposed to be easy and I need to get my heart rate down. But I think we can be so hard on ourselves. But just getting out there, setting your expectations somewhat, you know, maybe set them lower. And then when you feel good, you go out and you do a little more. But I think that too, Scott, is why trail running is so great. You can be on the trail away from other people and any perceived judgments that you might see that might keep you from reaching your potential.
And walking is a strategy. Right. So and we acknowledge that on the trail. There's places that you're allowed to do that. I think if you're on a road marathon, you know, walking is a sign of the failure or not prepping like you wanted to. But trail running, heck, we accept that. That's strategy. You know, you pass somebody walking, you're thinking maybe you should be doing the same.
Yeah.
Yeah.
AJW, one of the things that you referenced in one of your articles was a book and some lecturing done by, help me with the name, Brené Brown?
Brené Brown, right. Yeah.
And the title of her book was Power of Vulnerability, The Power of Vulnerability. Where is this power? Where do you perceive that?
Well, certainly, I mean, Dr. Brown has done a decade or so work on this. And I think her view on the power is that, you know, the power of vulnerability is that it's sort of her point sort of flips vulnerability on its head, in that it's much easier, she would argue, for one to just deny those experiences, to just live a life in which you're never vulnerable, you know, especially as you get older and get sort of set in your ways, that, you know, it's similar to, you know, being in a fixed mindset versus a growth mindset. But she simply says that the more you shield yourself from ever taking risk or confronting fears or dealing with the unknown, the less likely you are to ever do that. Conversely, the more you open yourself up to, you know, the fact that you could be exposed and you could look weak and you can look, you know, to the outside world like some sort of a failure, the more that you're willing and able to do that, the more prepared you are when real hardship comes along. There's a tragic death in your family, you're dismissed from a job, a relationship goes south, something terrible happens to a member of your family that you have to deal with that exposes or makes vulnerable all of you, that built on the experience of making yourself vulnerable, there's power. And that's really where the life and running analogy comes in, because when you're at the hardest, toughest, most grueling time in an ultra marathon is likely when you're most vulnerable. And when you can get through that, you're going to come out the other side better. So that's her point, and I think it's a good one. And that, you know, often she would even argue that modern society, and for example, for parents of young children, they try to shield themselves from disappointment and adversity and being exposed to something that might be embarrassing or frustrating to them or lead to failure. And that her argument is the converse is really true, that exposing them to that sort of thing at a young age sort of preconditions them to what life has in store.
You know, I said I was going to do a little comment. I was showing Don visually. I wanted a small
little comment.
But now I have two comments. Can I do two? The first one is as AJW started this description, I was thinking we need to call Stan Lee. Do you know who Stan Lee is, Don?
Well, I'll Google it.
Does anybody know who Stan Lee is? Stan Lee is like the famous comic book guy, superhero.
I thought you meant like Mr. Lee.
No.
Oh, okay.
You know,
Stanley.
Where this is, no, not Stanley. Stan Lee. Lee.
Okay. Well,
Lee is his last name.
I'll edit this. Go ahead, Scott.
Sorry, I shouldn't have to explain.
You know,
I'm
not editing anything.
I've noticed every time Don says, I'll edit this, he doesn't edit.
No.
Actually,
there's no time for that.
I put it in the intro in future podcasts.
But, you know, the superhero, that this, his superpower is vulnerability.
Ah.
Okay, go ahead. I won't take the second
you
one.
Don't,
go ahead.
You're going to disqualify your own second comment?
I forgot what
hey,
it was.
So I want to go to your point, AJW, about vulnerability and helicopter pilots. Helicopter parents, rather. Helicopter parents.
Yeah.
Those not letting a child find themselves in any place that might be harmful or emotionally or physically harmful, and how that might work against this next generation or any previous future generations.
So we should keep ourselves open ourselves to vulnerability and model vulnerability.
I'm not so sure kids have the sense of vulnerability, because they're not afraid to try anything, from jumping off couches to singing
right.
to dancing in front of people. Zero vulnerability. Perhaps
Ooh.
We instill vulnerability as a society into these young, impressionable minds.
Interesting.
Any thoughts on that, gang?
Well, I've started an unofficial focus group where I'm
just now.
No. Where I've been trying to get to know the children of ultra runners, because I have this theory that if you grow up as a child and then a young adult of an ultra runner, particularly if that person's been doing it for a long time, you are definitely predisposed to taking more risk. Mm. And because I know my kids, you know, when I try and helicopter on them and be like, you can't go out, you can't stay out after 11, or like, what are you talking about? You run all night long. You can't tell me what to do. So I do think that there's, yeah, and that's a little bit of a chicken or egg thing. I think the people who are drawn to ultra running, especially the really long stuff, you know, have a little bit of a hunger towards risk and perhaps create children that are like that as well. But on a more serious note, indeed, you know, parents, and there are definite fears that they might have in the world of, you know, bad people that are out there. But, you know, you talk to many adults now and who are ultra runners, they were the people who stayed out until dark and unstructured time. Mm. There was no such thing as play dates and all of that stuff. And so now basically their adult version of that is running ultras. And you, certainly you make yourself vulnerable. I think helicopter parenting, you know, is kind of here to stay. But organizations, whether they be sports teams or clubs or schools, you know, can certainly combat that by providing, you know, healthy, relatively safe environments in which kids can fail and make themselves vulnerable, whether they're in sort of obvious things like ropes courses or less obvious and more challenging things like 24-hour solos or orienteering or things like this.
Hmm. Candace, any thoughts on those? I don't mean to put you on the spot because I would edit this out if I put you on the spot.
No, I think, I would agree with your statement, Andy, about a lot of ultra runners probably come from a background of being raised maybe a little bit with a little bit more adventure in their life. Because I know for me, we would just go out. I had three other siblings and all of us would go out and be gone all day. Sometimes like when after dark and just went out and played and even without headlamps or anything like that. So I definitely wanted to find something that felt adventurous like that in my life. And I'll go out all by, you know, by myself solo exploring some of these 200 mile courses. So I think, yeah, I think there is a link, between your childhood and being vulnerable in that kind of way. And then wanting to be that way as an adult as well.
So in order for us to understand the definition of vulnerability, I was wondering, and I'll throw this out there, is vulnerability a synonym of risk, or is it a subset of risk? Because there's some things that I think that are not a problem for me. It's a risk, but it's not a problem. It's easy to make that decision.
So I'm before you one of you two answer, the other day we're coming back from a run, and here's what I think, Scott. I think you've eliminated vulnerability from your personal vocabulary or identification, because you said, I don't think I've ever been vulnerable, and I don't mean to expose that,
yeah,
that
no,
comment,
no, that's fine.
But I think what you just said is, I acknowledge risk. I acknowledge I'm in positions that might give me physical harm or emotional harm, but I've not been vulnerable. I think since vulnerability has such a negative connotation and we think of it as something negative, we're just going to avoid it.
Well, and the title of this podcast is a quote from Brené Brown.
You've already made...
Oh, yeah.
You've already made the title?
I do a lot of pre-work on this show,
that's
Freeman.
Risky. Should, that's
you,
risky.
You should know that. This is a quote from... is it Brené? Brené Brown?
Brené Brown.
Brené. Check out the show notes. You can pronounce it yourself. Is vulnerability... The definition of vulnerability is... our greatest measure of courage.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So anyway, let's do this. Rather than define it, let's throw out maybe some examples. Let's go round table of some examples of where you felt vulnerable in running. Let's just say running. Let's narrow it to just running. Where have you felt? AJW, you wrote two articles that we'll post on the show notes because everybody's reading them now.
Right.
On I Run Far about vulnerability and where you maybe attained a different understanding of vulnerability at Hard Rock 100 last year.
Yeah, certainly I did, and I think the reason the fundamental reason was that I was just so weak. I felt a lot, you know, as an ultra runner for 25 years, I prided myself on being strong and being able to persevere and being able to you know, force myself and will myself through bad situations. And I felt very, very much at my limits and, you know, and on more than one occasion felt like, I don't know if I can do this anymore. And that, I think, is where there's a fundamental distinction between risk, which is something that you can make happen, and vulnerability, which is something that tends to happen to you. You're forced by circumstance or by experience to be placed in a vulnerable position, sometimes because of something you've done, sometimes something completely out of your control. Regardless, you know, your true measure is how you respond in that situation. I mean, at Hard Rock, I just chose to, you know, sort of suck it up and get through. But, you know, the last 9 miles took me 6 hours. So that tells you a lot about how bad it was. And I think I can think of other examples, perhaps less extreme, where I felt more vulnerable in that the external expectations of me were so high, whether from my family or my friends or other people around. And even, quite frankly, in other areas outside of running, where you fail to meet expectations and therefore you feel, you know, weak and exposed. And I think Brown's argument is that feeling weak and exposed is not necessarily a sign of something wrong with us, but in fact, a sign of something right with us.
Hmm. Yeah, I'll take the next spot here and do a visual, like a teeter-totter, right? You have a fulcrum in the middle. And on the left side of this visual I'm painting for you, everything at risk, you know, I will reference specifically to a run you have coming up, AJW, which is Tahoe 200, and the one that I had the opportunity, thanks, Candace, last year to run. And I'll put on this left side of this teeter-totter all the things at risk. One, I'm not going to finish. Two, I'm going to have tremendous pain. Three, others that expect me to get this done, I'm going to let them down or not be that person. And maybe most important, I'm not going to be the finisher that I felt that I am. I'm vulnerable and taking a risk that maybe I'm not a completer here.
Yeah.
And it's okay not to finish a run when there are certain situations that are going on, but perhaps I wasn't going to finish this run because I just felt it was too much for me. And I didn't want to acknowledge that. Lots at risk on the left-hand side of this teeter-totter. But the more I load on that left-hand side, the higher the right-hand side goes. And the higher the right-hand side goes, that's the achievement, that's the reward. So I like it when there's a lot at risk because at the end, the accomplishment's even greater and sweeter. So that's my take.
So are you saying that you have to focus on and pile a whole bunch of stuff on the right side so that it outweighs what's on the left side?
The left side in this
or is it a result? Is it a result?
Is the risk side, right? And then your reward is that right side.
It's a result after the fact, not necessarily a frame of mind going into to outweigh and get your mind wrapped around so you can take on the risk of vulnerability.
Well, I hate to ignore our guests, but I will say that, or the co-hosts, but I will say that I do use, and maybe that's the power of vulnerability, I like loading that left side up. I love finding those things and because I want that other side to be real high. Yeah. I like that.
Okay.
Candace, any thoughts?
Yeah, I think any race I've ever done, I have felt pretty vulnerable at some point. But sort of a funny example for me, this past summer, I signed up for the Tahoe Rim Trail 100. This would be my second running of it. The first time I ran it, it was sort of my breakthrough race where I ran, I think it's still the fifth fastest women's time. And it was just, it sort of shocked me. And I had like that race, that best day race possible. And so coming back to that last summer, I knew I probably wasn't quite as prepared as I'd been that year. So I felt vulnerable in that way. Having had such a great experience. And also, you know, I'd moved to Tahoe, so I was able to train on the trails, so I should be able to do better. And I had sort of this vulnerability around all of that. And I went out and I just immediately felt off. You know, when you start a race and you're like, this isn't, you know, my lungs weren't feeling quite right. And I got to mile 50 where I had a pacer and I was going to drop because I could tell it was going to be a second 50 mile slog. And she was so excited to get going. And I really didn't want to just give up because things didn't feel right or it was going to be much slower than I'd run it before. So I buckled up and went on to that next 50-mile loop. And it was actually just an amazing experience because I gave up the expectation of I have to have this result. You know, I want to get a better time than I got the last time. And I ended up running almost 10 hours slower than I had it. I mean, it was just shocking, like way slower. And I got my finish. So, you know, I have like their special sub 24 buckle and I have over 30 hour buckle. But it ended up being an experience where I think people respected me more for finishing it. And I felt like I really toughed out. You know, it makes you feel tougher when you have such a hard day. And I was fine, you know, no lasting injuries. So it was a good experience.
You know what I find interesting of all three of your stories is, you know, when you're going through that vulnerability, you're thinking, I mean, there's all these bad things that can happen, you know, whether you are going to be hurt emotionally or hurt physically. But when you finally complete it, it's a sense of accomplishment and a badge, or if we're going along the superhero path, it's a patch that you can put on your chest and wear, or on your cape, if you will.
We're not going there, Scott. This isn't that podcast.
Captain Vulnerability, Don.
Captain V. tell us about your vulnerability.
You know, I'm gonna say I'm going through some issues with vulnerability now. I am trying to become more fat adapted.
Mm-hmm.
And in the course of that, I have not been running with people because I know that I have to be running slow. And every time I even go out to the trails, I'm putting myself out there because I'm going to be going super slow.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to run a little bit of embarrassment when I run across somebody or meet somebody on the trail. And I have people that's, you know, say, hey, let's go for a run, and I have to turn them down. I said, you know, I'm running slow, and I'm preparing myself for some races coming up, and I have one next weekend that I don't feel I'm ready for, and right now I'm feeling pretty vulnerable.
When the shadow of a tree passes you, Scott, you're moving kind of slow.
The trail keeps going backwards. I don't understand it. I have to start with a headlamp and end with a headlamp, and it's only a 5-mile run.
You were mentioning, Scott, AJW's Hard Rock, which,
yeah.
or Candace, your 27-hour finish. Did you? No, your
30.
It was like 32-hour.
Yeah. Okay, and so a 10-hour difference. So a 22-hour and a 32-hour finish.
Yeah.
And to yours, AJW, a Hard Rock and one of your tremendous Western States finishes. Do each one of those races hold a special spot for you as bookends in your running career and are equally important? And do you have as much joy in looking at them or having them on your shelf? Does that make sense? Is that even a question?
Yeah,
it is if you put a question mark at the end.
When I think of my most successful Western States, it was not, I have to admit, I didn't learn as much from it as I learned from my 41-hour Hard Rock because, and I mean, people hate it when I say this, but it was almost easy that day. Like everything came easily. I was ahead of my splits at every aid station. I dropped my pacer, you know, everything just clicked. I felt completely in control and on top of things all day long. It was euphoric. But there was nothing even close to the learning experience of the 41-hour Hard Rock in which I was, you know, exposed and vulnerable for about 30 of the hours. Interestingly enough, I hope to never have any of either of those again. In other words, they were on such extremes that Western States when I got second place and that Hard Rock when I got 41 and a half hours were so extreme in the experience that having lived through them just once is enough.
What you know, I'm interested, Andy, what did you learn by going through that vulnerability, vulnerable state at Hard Rock? What makes you better, stronger, smarter?
Well, first I learned that you when it's really going bad, that bad, you know, where I'm arriving at an aid station, you know, 6 hours after my crew was expecting me, you have to accept the fact that it's going badly. You have to name it. You have to say, oh, this is like Candace did after the first lap, you know, when she got to mile 50, this is going bad. And frankly, it sounds like it was only the happiness and excitement of the pacer that got her back out there. But that the second 50 was just great because of that, right? So that's half the battle, just admitting, okay, I'm open, I'm exposed, I'm out here. I mean, I'm not where I want to be in the standings. I'm not where people expect to see me, you know, whatever, if external issues matter to you, it's, you know, and they certainly did to me. It's like, oh my God, what happened to AJW? You know, he's finishing way back there type of thing. You have to just put all that, aside, chalk it up to, you know, experience, and then hope the next time that you're ready for it when it happens.
I want to direct, that was good, Andy, thanks. I want to direct this to Candace about those two runs. And so we're still kind of on that same topic. Would you, on this bookshelf, would you slide that one race off, that 32-hour race, and just eliminate it from your resume completely? Or does it hold a special place for you?
Hmm. I think the reason I finished it in the first place, because I had decided I was going to quit probably at mile like 30 something. And the reason I finished it is because I did want to hang on to it. You know, I did want to have that experience like deeper within myself beyond all the excuses. I wanted to have that finish because I've certainly had my share of DNFs. And at the time, and even some of them looking back, I'm like, that was the right decision, but I could have finished. And you always, at least for me, I always still have that thought, if I don't finish, like, you know, what would have happened? Like, I want that experience for, I want to at least end it on a positive note of having the finish, even if it's not going well, you know, unless I like break my leg or I've never had that good of an excuse though. So, yeah, so I would keep, I would definitely keep it. Although unlike you, Andy, I think I would much rather have the high of the second place finish every time, you know, that euphoria. But I just don't think that's possible. And I think that a lot of people start to get discouraged in ultra running. You know, let's say they have been successful and you see a lot of this, they do really well. And then all of a sudden, oh, they start to have regular races like the rest of people running. And I think it's important not to be discouraged, but I kept asking myself, why am I ultra running? It's not for these accolades. It was never for that in the first place. So that's not an excuse to quit either.
Mm. Well, yeah, I just derailed my question because what a great statement. You know, why do we ultra run? And this, if it's not for the accolades, then it must be for some internal growth or some internal mm-hmm. satisfaction or something in internal that needs to be filled in some way. So AJW, yeah, your definitely. Thoughts on that? That's Candace. That's so good.
Well, while AJW's thinking, I'm a visual person. I don't know if I know Don has not seen this movie because he doesn't go to movies. But
I'm not against movies. I just don't go to see.
You
them.
Are against movies.
All right,
Candace and Andy, did you ever see the movie In and Out? The animated In and Out.
I don't think so.
Scott, good grief! I'm not. You guys got to quit running so much. No, this had these little emotion, you know, somewhat it has this emotion in people's brains.
A bachelor
party.
Did
you see it?
Yeah, is it a bachelor party?
You're at a bachelor party.
Sorry.
Anyway, I just see in your head there's all these voices, and I can see now one is the voice of vulnerability, mm-hmm. and one is the voice of maybe ego, and how, which one gets the loudest attention in your mind? And I think that in some cases we picture this vulnerability voice as something that is bad. And I think in my mind, I'm trying to come around and understand it and say, no, that vulnerability voice is something good. And it kind of squashes and takes time away from the ego voice.
In every great accomplishment.
I'm gonna put a link in the podcast description to the movie so you guys can maybe see it.
every great accomplishment, there's been a risk factor. So, I mean, if nobody took risks ever, nothing would get done that was tremendous or worthy of noting.
You're right.
So, you know, the people that have accomplished were all in a state of vulnerability and allowed themselves to be exposed and raw to the rest of the world's opinions.
That's a really good point. We would still be sitting around fires right now.
Well, we wouldn't have fire because no one would have the courage to create it. Yes. So,
you know, I'd like to start the other focus group. I'd like to start in addition to kids, ultra runners, is people who've been running ultras for 10 years or more, because I would bet, I would almost put big money on this, that A, that they're all going to have some story, if not a series of stories, about times in which they were vulnerable. And two, perhaps most importantly, they run ultras for the intrinsic rewards, not the extrinsic rewards. Mm-hmm. And maybe even in their past, they won races or, you know, got silver buckles at hundreds and things like that. But for those who've stuck around and remained healthy, of course, because some people don't stick around because they get injured and stuff, it's probably because of those two things. They've opened themselves up to vulnerability and they know it can happen each and every time they lace them up and get out there. And they're doing it for something that's more inside than outside.
Let's just for a second explore this and about that group of runners that you're talking about that have stood on the podium, that just naturally as time goes on and Father Time wears on all of us, there's a vulnerable spot where that podium is only viewed and no longer stood upon. How do athletes wrap their head around that? And that vulnerability is very, very, it's a tough, less catastrophic place to be, both internally and having people watch. Any thoughts about?
If you look around, there's pretty much two sets of those people, and they're pretty black and white. They're the people who, once they were no longer on the podium, left the sport for whatever reason. You know, I think you can look at past issues of Ultra Running Magazine and look at top finishers, and you know, you're going to see a group that, God, I wonder what ever happened to that guy. And then there are the second group that kind of swallowed their pride and, you know, said they went from second place to 20th place to 60th place. Sometimes the plummet can be pretty extreme, you know, with Father Time hitting you. And yet, you know, those are some of the people you want to hang around with the most. I think of, you know, one of the godfathers of Northern California running, Dan Williams, you know, who was a top three Western States finisher several times and then, you know, struggled to break 24 for a handful of times. And, you know, then, you know, ended up getting his 20th finish and, you know, was racing the cutoffs a little bit. I mean, talk about a guy who just stuck it out and went from the podium to the middle of the pack and did it with grace and dignity. So I think they have to be able to embrace that part of it. And if they don't, they might choose to do something else. It's an interesting kind of study to see those two types of people.
On a small note on trail etiquette, it's never, ever okay to say, Scott Worth, you used to be up front. What are you doing back here with us? That is an uncool thing to say. There's many reasons why that person's back here with you. You don't need to ask him. You can kind of figure it out over the next 50 miles if you'd like. But don't ask anybody, why are you back here with us? You should be up front. That's not a cool thing to say.
I totally agree. I've had that question.
John, thanks for saying that, because I've gotten that a few times.
I've heard people say to me, what are you doing up front here? And I said, I shouldn't be. I need to.
That's completely okay.
It's mile
That's
two.
Completely okay.
Yeah, it's mile two. I need to slow down. You're right. I need to get back with my people.
I'm going to. I think too, you know, with people who stick around with the sport of ultra running longer term, coming back to like the vulnerability and that maybe being something we're seeking out. I think sometimes we have to find new ways to approach the sport. I've sort of been looking at that too, because I think as you find even that wins or, you know, top placings, that doesn't necessarily bring you what you're looking for in the sport. I found myself doing more and more long distance solo kind of adventuring, which is how I got into creating these 200-mile races. You know, I'd go out and explore all these trails in an area and figure out how I could put them together to make these events. But also I think, and maybe you guys can answer this too, like, what is it that's kept you interested and engaged and vulnerable in the sport of ultra running?
Wow.
Over time.
I may need a few hours to think about that one.
What's kept me engaged? Well, I'll just throw this out there without putting a lot of thought into it while you guys get your great thoughts together and come up with a decent comment. I want to prove to myself that I can still do it, that not trying and not doing it will automatically put this in my past, that people in my mind, people that are healthy and are optimistic and everything that I aspire to be, can be proven and tested on a trail. And if I let that go, then perhaps that component of who I am goes with it. So I want to stay out there and stay vulnerable.
Part of you dies?
Part of me dies. It becomes a part of my history and not part of my present. And I'm not ready to get rid of that present. So that's my thought.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one. And I think, too, so much of modern life and you know, my life is outside of running is product-oriented, you know, is results-oriented, is about, you know, what have you done for me lately? And I stay engaged in long distance running because it's a process activity, right? The actual race is the end result of sometimes 6, 9, 12 months of training and work and focus and organization. And that process, that day to day getting out there is just so exhilarating. And, you know, it doesn't matter anymore that I'm not a top 10 or at Western States or winning races, because the process is still the same. Of course, it's slower, but it's still the same. And I'm sort of renewed each time I build up another training cycle and get going for another year. And that then the cycle of confidence and vulnerability repeats itself. And there's something really, really almost addicting about that. And when you're in the midst of the process and you're like, okay, well, it's 8 weeks now till the race. How am I doing? You know, am I managing injury? Am I staying right on that edge? It's fun. And I think if I didn't have it in my life, I'd really miss that. I'd probably miss the process of training more than actual racing.
You know, I think I've come up with an answer. I think the reason why I stick with it is because, going back to the teeter-totter example that Don gave, is the reward is so great. And it may be the reward, not necessarily of racing and finishing a race at whatever time, but it's the reward of going out for a run and clearing your mind, having that time in your life in this society that we have now of information and noise, that you can almost meditate and come up with answers, reprioritize areas in your life. I think that's why I do it.
I have a question for you guys. Candace, did you have something you were going to add to that before?
She had something great.
I move to that next question?
No.
Okay. So I'm going to ask the question to the four of us. Is ultra running selfish? Is it a selfish activity? I know vulnerability is our topic, but this thought came to me as you were, Andy, you were talking about the hours that you spend out there, and I'm trying to just think, is it selfish, or are you setting an example, or is it important to become a you know, improve your own self as a person, which is an investment. I mean, where do we go with it? Is ultra running selfish?
Right,
Scott.
All right. I've thought a ton about this, and I can only answer for myself because I get that from time to time. Gosh, you spend so much time, just, you know, your family, they must be saints and so forth. And so, yeah. Okay. On the one hand, it's a selfish endeavor, right? You take hours away from your weekends, and you're up in the morning and you're tired at night, so you have to go to bed early, and you're eating tons of food, and your vacations are all planned around your next race. And all of these are real true examples of my life, right? So I get that and would probably be accused of being a selfish ultra runner. However, on the other side of the coin, and this gets into that process piece, without it, I would make those around me even more miserable than I already do. and they all know that. Now, that's the nature of having, you know, relationships that have gone on for years and years and years, whether with family or friends. But, you know, as miserable as I can sometimes be in the midst of a training cycle, I'm way more miserable, you know, when I'm injured and not able to run and so forth. So you could twist the argument around and say, well, it's a selfless act, because if I was just sitting around the house not running, I'd be grumpy and miserable all the time.
I will tell you that I have had discussions with bosses that I've had, and they know that I spend some time out there, and I have told them, I said, I am a better employee because I run. And you need to know that, you know, maybe some days I'm not starting work till 9 o'clock in the morning. It's because I'm out there and I come to work at 9 o'clock with better ideas, better priorities, better clarity of mind than if I would have woken up at 7:30 and got to work at 8.
Are you still with that company?
No. I've moved up.
Yeah.
How about you, Candace?
I think that you could look at it either way, but my understanding of the human body is we need movement, and the more kind of movement we have, and really it could be any exercise, the healthier we tend to be. So I think it's just something that we innately need to be healthy. And so I don't think that's selfish. I think that's self-care. There are times where we can take it too far, probably. If we're an ultra runner, I'm sure we have. but I do think it's just a healthy thing. And I don't think people should be worried about it being selfish. Usually we know when we're crossing that line.
Four people that run a lot. we're justifying our actions around the table. I love it. we should get those that are around us to answer that question.
Yeah.
No, is ultra running selfish?
That would be interesting.
Yeah, this is like having four alcoholics at the bar going, so do you think drinking, you know.
Do you think drinking's good for you?
Oh, yeah.
If I wasn't here, I'd be sitting on the couch eating Cheetos.
Yeah, and nobody wants me there. So let's take Andy's argument and take out the word running and insert drinking. I think it plays the same.
Oh, that's funny. Let's think about that for a minute.
Yeah. No, I, you know what? Perhaps running extends our lifespan as well. So it really is just an investment for the future, right? You live till 90 instead of kicking off at 65. Hey, that's priceless.
Okay. It's a lot of time.
I want to come back one more time to the title of the podcast, or the Brené Brown's use of the word courage when it comes to vulnerability. Yeah. And I do think there is a certain amount of courage that goes into, sort of being able to just open yourself up to being vulnerable, you know, courageous or brave or whatever you want to call it. Those aren't typically words associated with vulnerability, but I think it's an interesting tack to take because, courage requires a conscious effort to take yourself somewhere where perhaps your inner voices don't want you to go, perhaps where your parents don't want you to go, perhaps where your teachers or your significant other doesn't want you to go. You know, courage is going somewhere where, you know, no one's gone before, perhaps. And so the fact that being vulnerable is a courageous act, making yourself vulnerable, opening yourself up to experiences that make yourself vulnerable is courageous. I think that's pretty cool. And mm-hmm. I mean, Lord knows, Candace knows better than anybody else on this podcast as a race director of many races. You sit at the finish line of an ultra marathon and you see a lot of courageous people there. They're happy. They're content. They've opened themselves up to whatever the day has brought. And they're, you know, enjoying the spoils of that finish, whether it was first place or last place or anywhere in between.
Yeah. And you don't know whether that person's coming in first, middle, or last, what joy they're experiencing at that moment, because that right. journey may not have been their expectations, but that last place may be the happiest person coming across that line because they overcame more than you even know in that process. And perhaps that's why we at the finish line clap and yell so loudly at that golden hour, right? For all those runners that have journeyed that whole course. And that's why it moves us, you know, maybe mm-hmm. even more than the front runners.
Candace? And I've never seen such joy as I see at the end of these 4-day events, you know, when, or however many days it takes a person, you know, maybe 60 hours, but the joy of them crossing that finish line when they've been waiting for it for so long, it felt like it would never come. I mean, I've had 5Ks like that. It's like never over, but for 4 days, it's just an amazing, you know, amazing feeling. You can just see it on. How did you feel, Don, when you crossed the finish line of the Tahoe 200?
Yeah.
Was it different than other finishes?
It is one of my prizes of my life to have finished that, because of that teeter totter was so loaded on the left side with self doubt, of fear, of all of the things, like, you know, this is 200. I have died after 100. I've died after a 50. I have thought of excuses all the way through the miles through 100, but this is 200, and I didn't know how to handle it. And so coming in at the end was just all of those emotions packed in to a brief moment. And it is a condensed, maybe like the universe, what's the Big Bang Theory? It's that Big Bang. That finish mm-hmm. line takes all of those emotions, compressed 200 miles into a moment. And that's what the finish line is like.
Well, it's almost, again, I like Don's teeter-totter example. It's at that finish line is when you jump on the right side and all the things on the left side that you've piled up just go flying out the window, and they're no longer a concern. You've destroyed the left side.
Yeah, good. I like that.
And I will tell you, from a spectator standpoint, it was fun to watch Don, and we have a podcast on that you can go back and listen to, but it was fun to watch Don because at mile 106, beaten, 103, beaten, tired, questioning, vulnerable, what was the last aid station, 6 miles left?
191 or so. You have so many aid stations.
What's the last aid station? How many
Stephen
miles?
Stephen Jones.
Yeah, what is that, 191?
Yeah, I think it's because it's 205 miles. It's like 191. Yeah.
So watching Don at that aid station was a completely different Don. He was smiling and joking. We took a picture of him laying on the ground, spread eagle, just for fun. I mean, mm-hmm. and he was saying, I think that the process of unloading that left side of the teeter-totter had already started then.
Yeah. When does that unload? Can you recognize the time in the races, you guys, when that starts to unload, when you know it's yours? You know you're running a race, and there's question all the way through, but there becomes a point, some line somewhere that you know it's yours, right? I've got it. How about you guys? You guys experience that? You know that
Definitely.
It's questionable until I own it. This is mine.
Absolutely. And I think that's an excellent question, because it doesn't happen at the same place every time. You know, sometimes it's pretty far away from the finish line. Other times it might not be until you're within sight of the finish line. But you do have that moment of catharsis, that sort of galvanizing moment, as Scott was suggesting, where the teeter-totter just gets unloaded. And you just have to, as you know, it's interesting, Candace using the word wait for it. You know, you're running 200 miles, but you're also waiting a little bit to just get this thing done. You know, you're also waiting for that moment where it's like, okay, there's no more doubt. I'm going to finish this thing. It might be just in the last 100 yards. It might be in the last 20 miles. You never know. But when you get that feeling, it's got to be. I mean, there's nothing like it. And at that point, the vulnerability slips away and confidence comes back and the smile comes across your face. And, you know, the euphoria, like Scott, that you explained that you saw in Dawn in 191 and didn't see at 103 was because of that.
I relate this back to Marine Corps boot camp that I went through, and I had no idea. You talk about vulnerability, right? I had no clue. I could only imagine that it was going to be the worst experience, the most challenging experience of my life, which was true. And as there was a point that I knew it was mine. They could not do anything to me there that could derail me from a finish. Up until that point, I was nervous, vulnerable, frightened, unsure, questioning my own resolve, could I get it done? But there became a point where it was like, this is mine. There's no way you can take me
down.
Where
was that point?
About, it's a 3-month process. So about 2 months in, I was pretty certain that this was mine. They couldn't pile anything on me that I couldn't do. So there's that point other than just running, and it may be your job or maybe that new position you're in, or maybe it doesn't matter. You know, you can move this into any subject, but there's that point.
You know, again, this teeter-totter thing is a good metaphor. I would think that as you're starting a race, there's a whole bunch of things that are piled on that left side. But as you go through the race, I think that in many cases or in some cases, more stuff gets piled on.
Ooh.
More stuff gets piled on to the point where you're just, you know, almost broken. You're saying, there's no way that I'm going to be able to jump on the right side and get everything off. But there's that point where maybe some of the stuff starts falling away throughout the latter part of a race or whatever until the final point when you can just destroy it.
So perhaps, Scott, a DNF is when there's too much stuff on the left side and something's going to break and that's when we drop. But maybe we need to learn to unload some stuff off the left side. Maybe some things can be discarded and to make sure things don't break down.
That's a good strategy. I mean, if that's possible, maybe there are some strategies as an ultra runner that you can adopt or learn or train to try to unload some of that off the left side.
Have you ever unloaded HAW? Go ahead.
It occurs to me, guys, that one way, there's some wisdom in this for crews and pacers. You know, if you say you're a relatively inexperienced 100-mile runner getting ready for your first or second 100-miler, you might want to sit down with your crew or pacer a month or so ahead of time as you're planning for the race and say, hey, look, there's, you know, talk about the teeter-totter analogy and you can help me maybe unload some of this stuff. You can help me get closer to that galvanizing point, Don, where like you did it two months into boot camp, knowing that it's going to happen, but it's going to be a grueling battle to get there. I would venture to guess that you're absolutely right. The DNFs out there, you know, with the exception of the ones that are caused by, you know, serious injury, are likely caused by that teeter-totter just getting so outweighed that you can't possibly push on the other end to get any leverage. And so I think there's not only a lesson for the runner, but a lesson for those who are supporting the runner as well.
So in as we've got almost an hour here, let's end with this. How can we support others in this vulnerability piece and recognizing that vulnerability is strength and be good partners, colleagues, pacers, friends to others? Can we recognize where somebody's putting themselves at risk and acknowledging that, congratulating them on it, giving them a fist bump, saying, dude, you did it. You overcame that. You're awesome. Is there something we can do to make a better community with that?
Yeah, I think understanding how vulnerability makes us feel, you know, at the initial onset and then how good you'll feel if you make it through, just in general, being more compassionate to people who are experiencing something new. I recently picked up skiing and backcountry skiing and found myself more vulnerable than ever, you know, and so much gear to learn about and, you know, at the resort, you've got a lot of people possibly watching you fail and fall, and really you can't get better. And, you know, it's just, you've got to keep practicing. You've got to keep being vulnerable. So, you know, encouraging the people around us to go after their dreams, or, you know, if you're a coach, encouraging the people you're coaching, that kind of thing. I think it's really important, or our children, you know, to try new things, because it's a scary, it can be a really scary process without the right support.
Yeah, I would absolutely concur with Candace and add that we've got to figure out a way to destigmatize this notion of vulnerability as a weakness. That, you know, we all at one point or another are made vulnerable by something in our lives, by some circumstance, maybe in our control, but more likely out of our control. And it's how we, you know, step up to the plate and respond to that situation that that makes us better people. You know, the microcosm of long distance running is just a great, you know, test case for that. But I think if we can, you know, as an ultra running community, do our best to accept the fact that this is what we're opening ourselves up to, and that it's just fine and just okay that you're going to be this way. And whether you do it by, you know, being brought to tears or embarrassment because people are disappointed in you or whatever the case may be, you know, it's not weakness. It's something inside you that you have to deal with and eventually overcome. And then each time that happens, you're better off the next time.
When I think of the word vulnerability and courage and risk, and as we've used those, and I think about maybe the basketball court and somebody that's there on the free throw line in the final seconds that's going to make a swing in the game, and they and make a change in the game.
I like how you just went from basketball to baseball in that analogy.
What, swing of the game?
Yeah.
Oh.
Oh, you were saying swing of the game. Okay.
Right, swing the game.
Sorry, you can edit that out. That was stupid.
I will not edit that out. So this guy or gal is bouncing the ball to shoot through the net, and it could change the outcome of the game. Is that all right, Scott? The outcome of the game.
Yeah.
They're vulnerable, high risk, but great reward if they hit it. And I think about the people that never take the chance. Now, some of these spectators that are there certainly didn't have the opportunity to be in that spot. But those that don't try are merely spectators, and they'll never accomplish or experience that great feeling that that guy at the free throw line has because they put themselves in that spot. And so I think we should look to find ourselves at the free throw line, or put ourselves at the front of a race, you know, at a start line, wherever you're at the start line. We need to put ourselves there, become vulnerable, and it is a courageous event.
Put yourself at the door, lacing up your shoes.
Yeah. Any closing from you two?
That would be
I think this is a. I think this has been a great discussion, and you know, we're at the end of February, and we're probably talking to a lot of people who are starting to get themselves here in the United States prepared for some big summer adventure in which they're going to be made vulnerable. And I say, go for it. You know, you're going to enjoy the experience and hang on for a great ride.
Yeah. And I would say too, you know, keep trying new things, whether it be new sports or new distances, or, you know, set your goals as high as you can, you know, and 'cause you might just get that particular goal, or learn that you love a whole new sport.
Candace, if we wanted to find ourselves vulnerable at a race in 2017, where is it that we would go? We might find a race that you've directed, so we can get a little Candace flavor to our races.
I'll make all the listeners vulnerable. There isn't a single race that I organize that's not pretty darn hard. We even have we just put on the Fragrance Lake Half Marathon. It has almost 3,500 feet of climbing in that half marathon, which, you know, considering we get a lot of road runners, that's a lot of climbing. So you could go to destinationtrailrun.com.
Awesome. And I believe AJW, you have a date with Candace sometime in August at Homewood.
I hope it's September. I've got it.
Oh,
I
September.
Need
oh,
it's September.
September.
Yeah. So I've got.
Unless you're doing Bigfoot too.
No, I've got a 100-mile training run at Bighorn in June. So that'll be my little pre-race tune-up.
Perfect.
Well, we'll be out there too.
I fully expect to have some moments of vulnerability out there, but I can't wait. I really can't wait. I think I hope he'll continue to. Kirk Apt is on the list. You guys probably know the name Kirk. He's a 23-time or 24-time Hard Rock finisher, and he's dipping his toe into the 200 distance at Tahoe as well. So it'll be a lot of fun to be reunited with Kirk out on the trail.
Nice.
Yeah,
nice.
He's quite a legend. He was at the Bigfoot 120 in October. We had just driving rain the whole time. Yeah. He finished the race.
He's one of the great ones.
I would say if there's some listeners out there that are seeing that left side of the teeter totter really pile up to the point that it is maybe inhibiting them to try something, go be a volunteer at one of these races, because that helps unload that left side. Mm-hmm. Because you can see that it's possible. You can see that nothing catastrophic is going to happen. I think that's a good way to help overcome some of that.
Hmm. That explains that X in the middle of our logo, Scott. It's actually a teeter-totter overloaded on one side and then released. I get the wisdom from that now. So go out and become vulnerable.
I think you guys are giving Candace some bad ideas. She's probably going to have a teeter-totter out there at like mile 100 that we have to ride on for 10 times. You know, it's a 200-mile obstacle race.
and it will have special meaning for you guys when you're running the 200. When are you signing up, Don?
We'll talk about that offline, Candace. Hey, are there still spots open? That's what I want to know. And let me tell you, Candace does not need any help making things difficult. AJW, as you will find in her race, she simply takes the highest point and the lowest point, and then she connects the dots, and that becomes a trail. I was at mile, I forget which mile it was, but the great lady that was working there as a volunteer, she laughed and she says, hey, we're trying to get Candace to include that hill up there that you see as the next, as part of the course next year. And I laughed. And then as I started traveling, I realized I'm climbing that dang hill. She already included it. So Candace, you are an evil, wicked race director that we've learned to love.
You're welcome.
So go out and get vulnerable. I don't know. Scott, work with me.
Moss.
If it's bad, you got to just go with it, man. All right. Hey, guys, thank you so much. That was fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. Thanks a lot, guys.
HAW, that was your word. And, thank you. It was the seed of the whole conversation. So thanks.
I think it went well. We meandered around a lot of different topics, but... It was good. It was good. Don, I liked you throwing in the selfish question.
Oh, well, I mean, it's one that's ever present that we try to ignore, but it was the right time. What's our next word, AJW? Do you have a word for us?
Oh, I don't know. I'm sure something will come. Now that I'm increasing my training volume, something will come to me out on a run.
Perseverance, determination. Who knows? You'll come up with something and we'll get on and talk about it again.
Did you notice the Flow ad in Ultra Running Magazine? We did an ad in Ultra Running Magazine on Flow.
Did you really?
Yeah. So, Scott, send that on our group text, the Flow picture, because I know you have it.
Yeah, I have
Okay. it. Okay. So, and so our future ad coming up will be this word, vulnerability. And we'll define it and we'll get a really cool picture of it. And we've been using...
Well, In all seriousness, I think there's some other, in this word thing, there is some fun wordplay that you can take words like vulnerability that are generally perceived as negatives in society and then end up actually being strengths as runners and ultimately in life. One that keeps popping up is stubborn. Mm-hmm. You know, I think so many ultra runners are only successful because they're just doggedly stubborn, right? But you can get frustrated in your work or in your family for being too stubborn or set in your ways. But it's definitely a strength when it comes to running. So there's always another word we can come up with.
Hey, no, stubborn no surprise.
Is a good one. My dad always used to call me stubborn.
So it's like, I don't see that at all. I don't see that at all, Candace. No.
Well, you know, another word that's seen as negative, pain is another one.
Oh yeah.
You know, yeah. So negative, but also you need to play that pain edge to see results, I think, too. Depending on how you define it, but
pain has all sorts of applications of, you know, across life and, you know, physical pain, emotional pain, mental pain. Oh yeah, we could do a good one on pain, you guys.
Okay, yeah. Well, maybe no surprise to the people on the podcast, I am recording still, unless there's any objections, I'm going to leave this at the end, and we'll let listeners kind of determine whether it's going to be pain or stubborn as our next podcast topic.
All right, that sounds like a plan.
Okay.
Hey, thanks so much, guys. I'll let you get back to your training and directing and doing what you do.
Okay. See you guys later.
Thank you, guys.
Hey, thank you.
Bye.